Good morning. What makes thought about issues turn into action? The LA Times reporter you may know from the film The Soloist is asking that question as part of the HPU Homelessness Awareness Week. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll talk with Steve Lopez later this hour. In Hawaii, we make a lot of trash that often goes to landfills or to waste energy facilities. We'll look at how we got to this point and whether we produce enough trash to make the H-Power option a cost-effective choice. HPR's initiative, Trashing Paradise, starts today. It's Monday, March 30th. This is The Conversation.
And upcountry Maui is a Paniolo paradise. Today we'll hear from the Makawao History Museum. And a high school science project takes an innovative look at the world of signage and the ways we respond to colors. Those conversations and a few more coming your way right after a look at the news.
There's a little garbage for you in the morning. Actually, that's literal. That's the name of the artist. Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and welcome to The Conversation. Hello there, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Hey, there's sort of a novel notion in play here. Do we need to generate more trash?
Well, that's one of the questions that's going to be answered within the HPR initiative, Trashing Paradise. And we're going to get started with that now. You've heard those words, reduce, reuse, recycle. Yeah, we've heard those words a lot over the past couple of decades. Still, we make a lot of trash in Hawaii. On Oahu alone, about 600,000 tons of it. And although that may sound like a huge amount, not making more could be costing us. That's one of the issues HPR is considering in Trashing Paradise. First, though, we're going to get a little history of how we got to this point with HPR's news director, Bill Dorman, who joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So we always wrestle with this idea of trash. And, you know, some people have little composting going on and little things we've been told what we can do. But still, the overarching issue is that we have a lot of trash and we're trying to figure out what to do with it and what to do with it appropriately. But once upon a time, it wasn't like that.
Well, civilization in all forms, of course, always has had trash since the beginning. It's just part of a function of life. But what you do with that is complicated for us, of course, in an island situation. It's interesting if you go back to even just on Oahu in the 1920s. There was a 1925 report that said, at the very longest from the present outlook, it's but a matter of a year or two until either a different method must be provided for waste disposal, they're talking, or additional lands allowed for the disposal of refuse. So they're talking in the 1920s about running out of room. They did an experiment, actually, in 1928 about dumping garbage in the ocean. And they found that if you take it 5 to 10 miles southwest of the harbor, it would have no tendency to drift back to shore and would probably drift clear of any portion of the Hawaiian Islands. 1930s, you get incinerators being built for the first time. So, again, this sort of going through different methods of a universal problem of what to do with trash.
Well, once upon a time, that trash used to sort of be segregated. You had organic matter, and some of that was winding up as, you know, piggy feed and other things that, you know, if it came from the ocean, it went back to the ocean. There was a more, I don't know, it seems to come back from whence it came.
And more of a circle on that. And I got to refer to this. There's a great website, opala.org, has a Garbage in Paradise City and Council of Honolulu Department of Environmental Services, a man named Frank Young, who passed away a number of years ago. But he wrote up this wonderful history of the evolution of a lot of these things, and it's true that in the 20s and the 30s, pig slop was such a valuable commercial commodity that the separation of waste was done not out of some high-minded, this is best for the environment. It's because this is worth money, and this isn't part of the economic reality. And so that layer of economic reality on top of the Opala situation is something that I think you need to keep in mind, not just through history, but also for where we are now and some of the choices that we face going ahead.
Because once upon a time when Hawaii Kai and Kahala were, you know, piggy farms, that might have made sense in that way, but we got a lot of houses now and more coming. How is it that we look at how much trash we produce and where it's going to effectively go? And we hear people say, oh, it's going to go to H-Power, they're going to burn it. And then we have movements on college campuses and at schools that say, no, 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 you don't want to have any organic matter in there because that decreases the effectiveness of H-Power. So that really needs to be segregated again. And then there's the whole point of, well, are we producing enough trash, as we talked about in the opening, to be able to make this thing a cost-effective proposition?
It's true. So a lot of movement of on the economic front also has to do with government regulations. So as landfill laws across the United States were tightened largely in the 1990s, there was a large attraction for what they call these waste-to-energy plants. And the idea just sounds, oh my goodness, wouldn't it be wonderful if you could just burn your trash, produce energy, and everything would be wonderful, and that would take care of, you know, killing two birds with one stone. As with so many other things in life, it's a bit more complicated than that. And on these waste to energy facilities, on a lot, number one, they're very expensive facilities to build, to maintain. The contract, specifically with H-Power, it's under a condition called put or pay that you put in our case on Oahu, we need to supply 800,000 tons a year. As you mentioned, in the last fiscal year, we had 600,000 tons, and that wound up in the city and county of Honolulu paying more than $1 million, $1.1 million.
And those are taxpayer dollars.
Those are taxpayer dollars. That is part of the economic picture of this. Now, you also sort of need to step back and take a look at, okay, what sort of consumer behavior does this incentivize when it comes to recycling? Because, yes, recycling, reuse, reduce, recycle. And yet, if it's, well, just sort of toss it into H-Power because just going to burn anyway.
The trash.
Exactly. It's our patriotic duty. It sort of puts some, turns some things on its head a little bit under the banner of unintended consequences. But again, this is a complicated issue because one other point I would just say on waste to energy, by the way, when that came out. Waste to energy qualifies under a decision made at the Environmental Protection Agency as renewable energy. So that's the same category, wind, solar, geothermal, other renewable, because the finding from the EPA was that garbage is an infinite supply. It's not something that is going to run out. So based on that line of thinking, it qualifies as a renewable energy source, which then adds another layer for policymakers who say, ooh, not only do we burn waste, we produce electricity, but this counts as renewable energy.
Which makes it all look very, very good and very, very attractive. But more importantly, it's sending a very mixed message to people because there's been so much activity that's been done to generate campaigns to tell us about recycling. Many organizations that are looking to that, we, you know, had bins and then the sort of bins went away depending upon where you are, that we keep getting these very mixed messages. And at the same time, we're also having to foot the bill for H-Power.
There are a lot of layers to this story as well, and they vary a bit island by island. Some carry through the state, and so it's going to take us more than 5 days to go through this, but we'll be going through some aspects of this, raising some questions and, again, some points of awareness that people might not have thought about. And again, as we weigh options and decisions for the future, things to bear in mind. Little context, little background, never hurt anybody.
And a lot of nuance, too, that maybe we haven't paid attention to in past because it looks so good just to take your trash and burn it or do something else with it. Thank you, Bill, very much. We're looking forward to the series coming out of the news department, and we'll be having some talk about that, too, as we go through this week in HPR's initiative, Trashing Paradise.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR 2. It's 8:13, and coming up, a Maui town whose history is there for all to see. But first, your quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we're taking a look at a historic Oahu community that's home to some 3,970 souls, at least according to the 2010 census. It's a popular tourist destination known both for picturesque plantation-style buildings and access to nearby surfing and diving beaches. It's located on Wailoa Bay at the mouth of Anahulu Stream. There's a boat harbor in the middle of town with beach parks on both the north and south sides of the community. The twin-span Rainbow Bridge over Anahulu Stream acts as the entrance to the historic older part of that town. It was given its name in 1898 when businessman Benjamin Dillingham opened a hotel there. And it's the name of the town that we're looking for this morning. Do you know it? Call us if you do at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. There's an HPR t-shirt in it for the first caller who gets it right.
Good morning, I'm J.C. Michielanek from Good Beginnings Alliance. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR 2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
If history is to be kept alive, it needs help from dedicated volunteers. And all over the country, people who've preserved memories of days gone by have done it in the form of old photos, newspapers, and family scrapbooks. They're filling the archives of local historical societies and uncovering priceless material. In upcountry Maui, volunteer effort has created the Makawao History Museum. And as Museum Director Gail Ainsworth reminded us the other day, Makawao is a perfect place to relive Hawaii's past.
Well, Makawao, unlike most places in Hawaii, is very much preserved. Its character is preserved. The buildings are preserved. It's a delight to walk through the town. And you can just feel the history by walking through. And the area, too, we still have agriculture. We still have ranching. We have a wonderful rodeo and parade. I mean, I could go on, and I will.
Well, but the idea is that it has been kept alive more than places that have been kind of overrun by the modern world, yeah?
Well, that's true. And I think there has been a real pride in Makawao by its residents. And so they want to talk about it. They want to share that. And they want to share it to all local people, the people who come into our museum are from all over the place. They're certainly tourists, too, but also local people from around Maui and Oahu, and we get people from all over the place, and they find this history fascinating.
What brought people to Makawao originally? What was the attraction about that part of the island?
Well, if we go back to ancient times, it was the site of a Hawaiian village, so mm-hmm. It started there. And when the Chinese immigrants came, they did a lot of things. We have Chinese Paniolo and whatever, but they also were storekeepers and a variety of things. But, Makawao is really known for its Portuguese immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that they came to Makawao, it started with the sugar industry, as all immigrants to Hawaii were connected to.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were recruited from Portugal. But they actually didn't come from the main body of Portugal, at least most of them. They came from Madeira and the Azores.
Yeah, I've heard
and
that.
And these are the archipelago on Portugal. And they're very rocky and mountainous. So their land was at a real premium. And So when the Portuguese came to Maui to work in the sugar fields, they often had a dream of being able to own land to farm and ranch. So when their contracts were up, some of them, certainly not all of them, but some of them pursued that dream. And so where was the perfect place geographically and climate-wise?
Yeah.
Makawao. And so we have been noted for a very long time as a Portuguese community.
And so with that heritage comes all kinds of things, including styles of food. You always see that reflected in an immigrant community, don't you?
Oh, we love our bean soup and malasadas. And we do today have a very active Portuguese community association.
What kind of things would we see on a visit to the Makawao History Museum? What are some of the artifacts of the different ethnic groups that pass through there?
Well, we're proud of our Paniolo background.
Sure.
And so we have a wonderful saddle that is adorned in the Hawaiian way with rawhide.
Uh-huh.
And we have other leather things. We have not just ranching, but polo. We're well known for our polo. We have two different polo seasons. And so we have photos and items related to polo. And we've got wonderful biographies of Portuguese people. And also, I don't want to say we're all Portuguese. We've got Chinese and Japanese and Filipino. And all those cultures are represented at the museum.
And I see where you're doing exhibits going by sort of according to ethnic groups. An exhibit of the Hawaiians, the Chinese, the Portuguese, et cetera, right?
Absolutely. You know, we have our regular exhibit. And which I must say, I really have to brag a little about this because we're a small museum. When you come in, it is so well presented that people enjoy it. Even kids, we've got things for kids. We've got a 5-foot-tall horse and various things. So we do welcome everybody, and everybody sees something in it. However, we wanted to not just have our regular exhibits. We wanted to be able to have some changes so that we could get more people in for the second, third time or whatever.
Sure, sure.
And so we started with our first, which was about Haleakala Dairy, and then we have grants now to do all the different ethnic groups, and we're just about finished with the Hawaiian one. And our Hawaiian one is related to Hawaiian music. And so, as you know, Hawaiian music related to Makawao.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been very, very interesting.
Well, there's a real connection between Hawaiian music and the whole Paniolo tradition, because that's where the guitar came from.
That's very true. I can't believe how successful we've been from the very beginning. We're not even a year and a half old, and we have had so many things going on. And we've done tours of the museum as well as the town. We've had talk story sessions. Makawao has a third Friday event every month, and we have special activities related to that.
Uh-huh.
And we're now thinking about moving toward oral histories. So in that sense, we're definitely growing. We're not just a museum. We have all sorts of program things going on.
I think that collecting...
one of our more popular ones, we have a walking tour of Makawao. It's a self-guided walking tour of Makawao.
Uh-huh.
So anybody can come by, pick it up, walk through the town, and be guided through imagining what life is like in the 20s, 30s, and 40s in Makawao.
I think people get a lot out of that, don't you?
I certainly hope so. I do. And as I mentioned before, the town, the center of the town, none of the buildings are any later than the 40s, and most of them are from the 20s and 30s.
That says a lot right there.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Gail Ainsworth is the director of the Makawao History Museum, and you can learn more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
When the skinny envelope arrives,
it seemed like I was like in a scary movie because all of my friends were just getting their acceptance letter. I was just the one who was getting rejections letter one after the other.
Being rejected from your top school, it doesn't have to mean life as you know it is over. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Contributions for Challenge 2015 support the purchase, creation, and delivery of HPR services to the station's 175,000 weekly statewide listeners. We gratefully acknowledge Jerry and Irene Kubo of Kamuela, Jeff and Carol Martin of Mountain View, and Walter and Shirley Lasky of Honolulu. Thank you all for your early gifts. Now, when it comes to pledge drives, it's not a matter of if, but when we'll reach the designated goal. Early giving can mean fewer on-air pledge days. It's your call. Many first-time givers are choosing the convenience of HPR's $10 a month sustaining member program, and you can find a donation form at hprhawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for today's programming comes from UH Outreach College, presenting Celtic harpist and storyteller Patrick Ball in The Fine Beauty of the Island, 7:30 p.m. this Saturday in Orvis Auditorium, outreach.hawaii.edu/community.
You may hear strains of a national story in our next conversation. In Hawaii, public officials are allowed to use personal email for public business. But how are those communications saved and available for disclosure? Many agencies don't know, and that raises a question about what's happening with official email sent through personal systems. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning and happy Monday, Beth Ann.
And a good Monday to you, too. Well, I mean, obviously the situation with Hillary Clinton's controversial use of private email during a lot of her time as Secretary of State probably, you know, made us look at what's happening here.
Right.
But as you were going about trying to find out some of the answers, were people at all, you know, confused about the idea of using personal email systems to be able to send, you know, public, official business?
You know, Marina Riker, our reporter, called around to a lot of different state agencies as well as the city and got a variety of answers, pretty much vague on what the actual policy is. And I should clarify, the state policy from the Department of Accounting and General Services, it doesn't forbid explicitly the use of a personal email, right? Like a Google account or Yahoo. So in that case, in theory, one could use a personal email to conduct public businesses. But the folks that we called, including the governor's office, the mayor's office, and others, they didn't know. Most of them, whether they thought most of their employees probably used a government account, but they weren't exactly sure. You'd think it'd be a little bit more top of mind given what has gone on with Secretary Clinton.
Well, true enough. But because they don't seem to know whether it's happening or not, that also makes us ask, have they even asked the question of their employees? Have they even brought it up?
No, in many cases they have not. And the real concern here, in addition to important government information perhaps being used on a personal account, is what if we need to see those emails? What if a public records request goes through? That's something that the media often do. Civil Beat gets a lot of its stories through its public records request. But in fact, there's a question as to how those personal emails, if they are being used, how would they be saved and how would you retrieve them? And that was something that a lot of people are vague on. I should explain something that struck me as kind of surprising. The government here, the state server, emails are deleted after 60 days automatically unless you intentionally print them out or save them elsewhere. So there's a concern of a whole lot of data already being lost unless someone takes the steps to save it.
And in some cases, it could be in their interest to do that or to simply not save it. So at this point, because we don't really have a policy, is this getting any traction to create one?
One wonders if they should maybe update. There are some existing state guidelines, but they date back to 2002. And as you know, a lot has happened in the digital world since then. For example, that guideline says you should print out the emails or, get this, save them to a CD or a disk, like a floppy disk. I mean, my gosh, I mean, how many people still do that? I don't even have a CD drive on my laptop. Of course, people use external hard drives, right, with the USB drive and thumb drives and things like that. So that shows that perhaps the state's guidelines in terms of archiving important emails need to be updated. Maybe that's something that this story will help stimulate.
Well, we'll have to wait and see, because clearly nobody seems to be asking that question or even caring about that until we had the whole issue about Hillary Clinton.
That's right. We are. We're asking.
Oh, I know. But, you know, if that hadn't happened, would that be something that would have kind of gotten into your brain? Maybe, maybe not. But glad it did. And we'll talk about it more. And maybe you'll even get some answers. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Straub Clinic and Hospital, a proud healthcare partner of University of Hawaii Athletics. Learn more at straubhealth.org.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, these are very difficult decisions, end-of-life decisions, yeah?
Well, it's going to be an interesting discussion today.
Yeah.
We have a national advocate who just so happens to be on vacation here who agreed to come on the show and talk about what she talks about all over the nation, which is Oregon's death with dignity law. And is this something that we need to take a look at here? And what does this mean for caring for people as they go through those end-of-life times?
How is it different from the Oregon law, different from Hawaii's?
Well, Oregon passed a law that stated that it is allowable to have physician-assisted suicide, and that's not a law that is currently here in the islands. We do often, when people are in hospice or in other situations, do things very similar, but it still would be breaking the law if I were to help somebody if they were in their last times of life and give them medication or something that would accelerate their demise. So it's a legal issue, but today we're going to look at it from the medical perspective and what does this really mean for healthcare providers and for their people that they care for.
Kathy, is your guest a death with dignity advocate?
Yes, they are. And so we're going to look at both sides of that approach. And, you know, here's somebody who's definitely for it, and yet there are some other folks who definitely are against it. So this is going to be a great time for callers, and everybody can be part of this show. And we encourage everyone to express their opinion.
This is something that people really need to understand. Thanks very much, Kathy.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
Maybe you think about issues in Hawaii. Maybe you think about them a lot. But what does it take to make those issues touch you enough to engage? This afternoon, a man who found himself drawn into the issue of homelessness through his encounter with a schizophrenic cellist will lead those discussions. You may know about his experience from his book that became the film The Soloist. And we're very pleased to welcome LA Times columnist Steve Lopez in our studio this morning. Thank you for being here.
Well, it's good to be here. Thank you.
There's this strange thing that happens when you just know that you have to get involved with something. It's not academic anymore. It's not just something that you may, you know, care about peripherally, but that just draws you in. Do you have any idea from all of your experience in writing about people and the things that they deeply care about and your own experience with Nathaniel Ayers, what really is that magical thing that draws somebody in?
Well, can I make a confession? When I was
here
drawn,
on the radio, sure.
Yes, just between the two of us, let me make a confession. When I was drawn in, it was a selfish interest. As you noted, I'm a columnist, and I'm out on the street looking for columns. And what I saw the day that this whole adventure began for me was a guy standing on a street corner near the Beethoven statue in downtown Los Angeles playing a violin that was missing two strings. and playing with all his heart. This guy was intense, and I noticed that he was standing next to a shopping cart that appeared to contain all of his belongings, and on the side of it, he had written Little Walt Disney Concert Hall. And in Los Angeles, the big Walt Disney Concert Hall is the home of the LA Philharmonic. It's a few blocks away. So all I'm thinking is, I'm not thinking I'm going to save the world today. I'm going to, you know, solve homelessness and deal with mental health, public policy. All I thought was, this guy could be a column. So that's my confession. But what happened?
But somehow, though, excuse me for everything, though, that good story changed. I mean, very clearly, you could have walked away, Steve.
I could have, I suppose. But he charmed me. His name, as you said, is Nathaniel Ayers. He grew up in Cleveland. He took a music class in public school. He was so good and practiced so hard. He got a scholarship to Ohio University and then later to the Juilliard School for the Performing Arts in New York. And the more I spent time with him and the more I learned from him, the more committed I became to the cause. And so at a certain point, it was no longer about the columns. It was about this guy who I respected and even admired and even looked up to. And I thought, well, you know, you see somebody on the street, they're talking to themselves, they're disheveled. The natural, you know, instinct is to move away and to avoid any kind of contact. And what I learned from Nathaniel is that so many of those folks have a story. They've met with some trauma. They've been struck down often through no fault of their own. In his case, you know, diagnosed when he was at Juilliard, when he was in an orchestra with Yo-Yo Ma, diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, and a career that was about to take off instead went off the cliff. And here he was struggling for years to just make something of his life and so determined to get back on track that he's playing that violin, missing two strings, can't afford the other two strings, doesn't know how he's going to get them. And I just thought that that said so much about, you know, who's out there. And when I spent time with him on the streets, when I spent a night with him on Skid Row, I looked around and we have literally thousands of people. I mean, we're about 50,000 people homeless in greater L.A. And I began to meet people who didn't go to Juilliard but had some story of a break. You know, it was a mental health thing, or they were combat veterans back from wars and they were, you know, broken mentally, physically, psychologically. They missed a mortgage payment. They lost a job. They had domestic, you know, issues. They were on the streets. They had undiagnosed mental disorders. They needed to self-medicate. They took a drink. They hit a crack pipe. And their lives were out of control. And that is who's out there, whether it's Honolulu, whether it's Los Angeles, New York. You know, there are some predators. There are some folks out there who are trying to get over on somebody. But a lot of folks are brothers and sisters and sons and daughters who had a bad break and are out of control. And what really began to upset me as I looked at this more is that we know how to address this. We know what works, and there just has not been enough of a public commitment to it.
But the first thing that you talked about in terms of the engagement part is understanding that these are people, and these are people with stories, and these are people with lives. They're not something that's nameless, faceless, some sort of, you know, a commodity that should be pushed away,
right.
That these are living, breathing people. Now, before we let you go on about other things I want to talk to you about, just very briefly, what's happening with Nathaniel Ayers today? I'm sure a lot of people want to know that.
Okay, I just hit my 10-year anniversary with Nathaniel. It's been 10 years that we've been pals, and I've been trying to help him through this system. It took a year to talk him into housing, and that's one thing for people to, this is an important point for me to make, because you might see somebody out there and the police say, hey, there's a bed at the shelter. If you don't want to take it, then the heck with you. Why should we even bother? It takes what's known in the industry as outreach in order to gain somebody's trust, because they might be dealing with a serious mental disorder, and you start with meeting them where they are. Are you hungry? Here's a sandwich. Are you cold? Here's a jacket. Would you like to take a shower? Come back to the shelter. And you work on it from there to try to reel them in and make them comfortable in a new setting and provide them with these services. So that's how this can all begin. And in Nathaniel's case, that worked. But it took a year. It took a year to get him into housing. He's had some issues in housing. And now for about the last year and a half, he's been in a mental health recovery center where he is better than he's been in the 10 years I've known him. He is He's mellowed out. He's playing hours and hours and hours of music. Each day I go to visit him once a week, usually taking him fixed instruments that he wanted me to repair for him. So our relationship is strong and as good as ever.
I want to ask you about your latest column, the one about the Mendez Reading Club at the high school that came out over the weekend. When you talk to the kids, and of course they're in this column talking to you about the fact that they're reading every Monday, like today, but do you have a sense that some of these kids are more prone to being engaged, or is there something magical about what's happening in certain little pockets that we're not paying attention to enough that perhaps we should?
Well, let me set this up for you. Mendez High School is in the Boyle Heights area of Los Angeles, just east of downtown. And there are a lot of kids dealing with a lot of socioeconomic issues, and they come to school, and they do not come from environments where there are books in the house. Both parents might be working. The parents haven't been to college, so it's not that easy to get kids interested in books. But two teachers there, Rebecca Cariaga and Kim Lang, went out of their way to find books that would appeal to the specific interests of this student or that. And they lured them in with pizza, come on to the library, let's start this reading club. And they got hooked on books, and now I got a chance to walk with them to an L.A. Reads event last week. The whole city is reading and talking about a book called Into the Beautiful North by Luis Urrea.
Well, I love the column, and I'm glad to know that at least some kids are still reading, particularly there in Boyle Heights. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wish we had more time to talk.
All right.
Steve Lopez is an award-winning L.A. Times columnist. His national honors include the H.L. Mencken and Ernie Pyle Awards. He was also the 2011 Pulitzer Prize finalist for his elder care columns. Steve Lopez will be leading discussions on civic engagement later today. You can find the details on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a town on Oahu that's popular with locals and tourists alike. It's a surfer's mecca, and for many, the gateway to Oahu's North Shore. Landmarks include the Rainbow Bridge that spans Anahola Stream, acts as the entrance to the town, Matsumoto Shave Ice, and two beach parks, one on either side of town. There's a small boat harbor located in Waialua Bay, and in winter, when the big waves roll in, traffic can get pretty intense. It's abated somewhat by a new bypass route called the Joseph P. Leong Highway that extends State Route 83 to just north of town. On December 7, 1941, the only fighter aircraft that managed to scramble against the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor took off from a nearby airfield, since been abandoned. We asked you for the name of this popular community, and it came from businessman Benjamin Dillingham, who opened a hotel here in 1898 and named it Hale Iwa, which means House of the Frigate Bird.
And Kulia, I hope I'm pronouncing one of those well, from Kailua called us, had the right answer. So a T-shirt is coming your way. We also had calls from Kian Webb from Hale Iwa, Mark called us from Schofield, and Michelle from Kaneohe. They all had the answer, too. It's just that they were just not as fast on the draw as our first one. And we have one T-shirt to give, so better luck next time. But we're so glad you had the answer and really appreciate that you called in. Thank you.
At 8:45, that's today's quiz. And if you have one, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii, honored to be named one of America's best banks by Forbes for six consecutive years. Learn more at boh.com/bestbank, member FDIC.
T Time for Stargazer, our weekly look at what's happening in the world of astronomy, plus what's happening in our island skies. As usual, we turn to Christopher Phillips, Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's going on?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. Venus and Mars continue to be seen in the western horizon just after sunset. Mars will set around about 8 p.m., followed by Venus at around about 9 p.m. Jupiter will be visible in the eastern sky from sunset onwards, while Saturn will rise around 10:42 p.m. Despite the full moon, we may still be treated to a very bright pass from the International Space Station on Tuesday, passing from the south-southwest to the south at around 7:50 p.m.
Now, I seriously doubt that the ISS is involved with our next story, but you never know. Capturing an asteroid.
Yeah, that's right. This week, it's a space mission that sounds like it's right out of the Evil Genius playbook. It is a mission to capture an asteroid, or to be more specific, a piece of an asteroid. NASA is designing a spacecraft that will travel to a nearby asteroid and snatch a large boulder from its surface.
And what would they get with this rock?
Well, this mission is designed to test the technology that we would need to capture larger asteroids in the future. This particular mission will see the spacecraft haul the rock into orbit around the moon. Now, as well as the obvious scientific value of the mission, the ultimate goal is to make asteroid mining a viable industry.
And these things can be dangerous too, right, Christopher? There could be material on that that's unsafe.
It's possible that there could be volatile ices and things like that. And also there's the risk of the asteroid running out of control and possibly impacting the moon.
But nothing like I guess I was thinking more like a virus or something like that.
Oh, nothing like that.
Okay. That would be life, I guess.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
There was a virus. We discovered life. But bad news is it's going to kill us.
It's coming right at us.
And so why mine asteroids in the first place?
Well, asteroids contain all sorts of valuable minerals and ices. Everything from frozen water to gold, platinum, and iron. If we can make asteroid mining a viable industry, then we would have access to a near unlimited supply of resources.
Sounds more positive than people drilling and doing that sort of thing on the Earth.
Absolutely.
And since we've covered things like sea monkeys in space and other questionable material on the program, where does this fall on the realism scale?
Well, asteroid mining is a very realistic possibility, but we're still a decade or so away from it becoming a real industry. However, missions like this are the first small steps towards a brighter future for humanity and for planet Earth.
Christopher Phillips, Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee, and our report, thank you.
Thanks very much, Dave.
You are welcome, and I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week for Stargazer.
We guide ourselves through the world by the signs we read, and often we make vital decisions based on warning signs that we see at a glance. We don't always have to read the words to know what to do. We react as much to their color as to their language, the red of a stop sign, for example. Caitlin King is a St. Andrews Priory sophomore who thought about the ways people respond to signage and to color and made her findings the subject of a project for the State Science and Engineering Fair. She's with us this morning in our studio. Good morning, Caitlin.
Good morning.
The signs are really, really important for obvious reasons, but what made you think about the whole idea of what color they are?
Well, I started by reading articles online and seeing that there was effect of color, that people found that since red is associated with danger and blue is associated with calm, that that will affect how people make decisions. And I thought that was interesting, and maybe I should look more into it.
So if you had a warning sign against a soothing blue background, it might not have the same impact as to grab your eye, huh?
Yeah, likely not. If you wanted to warn someone of a danger or to make them stay safe, then red would be the best option.
So you looked at, as I understand your study, it looked at a couple things, the color of a sign and also the way it's phrased, right?
Correct, yeah.
What's the difference in the way you might phrase a warning? What was the example that you used?
So for framing, in this specific example, it was framed in terms of gains or losses, mm-hmm. or positively or negatively. So in this specific situation, the way it was is the positively framed things concerned how many people would be saved. For example, if program A is adopted, 200 people will be saved.
This is in a disease outbreak, right?
Yes, in a situation regarding the outbreak of a deadly disease. Mm-hmm. So the positively framed ones regard how many people will be saved, because saved is seen as a gain.
If you make a certain decision, right?
Yes. All the options for the positively framed is if you make this decision, blank people will be saved. Mm-hmm. But then the other side is the negatively framed ones, which say, if you make this decision, for example, 400 people will die. So this is associated with losses because people will die. So basically, we're trying to see if wording it differently, people being saved and people dying, will that have an effect on how people choose?
You could, I mean, the idea being obviously to prevent this, but you, one is a positive, you could save people. The other is if you don't, you'll have this negative result, right?
Yes.
So saying if you don't do this, the whole sort of dire warning idea, if you don't do this, you'll have this negative result, that has a, that doesn't work as well on people?
Yes. Well, if you say that there will be a negative result, or you talk in terms of losses for anything, like you're going to lose this, mm-hmm. something bad's going to happen, it's going to make people kind of panic because they see, well, I don't really have a choice, so I should just try to take that risk to try to make the best of the situation.
Sort of don't do this, danger ahead, and that gets an irrational response from people in a way?
Yeah, like that.
So you kind of, a warning sign can either rattle people, is what it sounds like, right?
Yeah.
Or else it can say, if you do this, you'll get a positive result.
Yeah, that's what we were looking at.
And where do colors come into all this?
So colors in my experiment were used as kind of the background for the survey that the things were presented. So people were looking at mainly a color. For example, red or blue.
Mm-hmm.
So for the red, we wanted to see on the red, would people really make a safer decision? Because like we said, red's associated with danger. They're going to want to be safe. So we tried to see if red would make people make safe choices. And then blue, again, since it's associated with calming, are they going to try to make a riskier choice?
So it sounds as if the ideal sign, or if you need to tell somebody about, say, the warning of a disease outbreak or something like that, it sounds as if the ideal way to do it would be to phrase it as a positive outcome on a blue background?
Yes, that is one possible way. A really good example to kind of visualize this is, for example, the vaccination issue of today. So if you wanted people to get vaccinated and maybe take a chance on a new medicine, then you should make it a blue background because they will want to take that risk and get vaccinated.
Red background would make them uneasy?
Yeah, it would. Red should be used more for warning against certain things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, if you wanted to tell people, don't smoke or do this so you can be safe, then red would be the color to use.
And ideally, a non-smoking warning might, instead of saying these are the horrible things that could happen to you, you might say you'll have better breathing, better wind, that you'll offer a positive.
Yeah, that's how it works. It's really interesting.
How did you go about this? Who did you survey?
Well, I made the surveys by myself. I just put them together. And then as for testing, I tested students at my school from middle school to high school.
Uh-huh. And get a pretty widespread response. How did the response go?
So for the results, I found that they were kind of split, and the actual results didn't quite go how I thought it would, but that was pretty interesting. As for the actual feedback, after I tested them, a lot of the people were pretty interested. They wanted to know, were the results how we thought? Were the results correct? Because they thought it was right or wrong, and it was really interesting because a lot of people seemed pretty interested.
A lot of times when you do a survey like this, you inevitably form a picture in your mind of what the result's going to be, but yours was a little different, right?
Yeah. I really thought that red would have a really big effect and that whoever had the red background color would be making safer options, but I found that red didn't really have as much of an effect as blue did.
You're going to pursue this kind of activity, aren't you?
Yeah, I hope to.
Great, Caitlin. Thanks very much. Good to talk to you this morning.
Yeah, thank you.
Caitlin King is a St. Andrews Priory sophomore who surveyed students in 6th through 12th grades for her State Science and Engineering Fair project. And you can find out more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
I hear a bunch of my hat, and I went in to ask him why. He said, you look like a fine, upstanding young man. I think you do. So I took out.
passing would be shot on sight. Some of my favorite programming on Hawaii Public Radio, of course, Bite Mark's Cafe. We always enjoy what Britt and Ryan are talking about and how they spread the news about local technology, innovation, and entrepreneurship here in the islands. It's important to support Hawaii Public Radio because it's a chance for voices to be heard. It's a chance for the community to tell their story, and it's a chance for everyone to learn a little more about what they're interested in.
Member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Radio with vision. Listen and see.
For a lot of people who may not have clued into Steve Lopez until The Soloist came out, either in book form or the film, he's been writing in L.A. and he's been involved with TV and news and journalism for a very, very long time. And he has a very long list of credentials and awards. But what he's doing in trying to get the rest of us to focus on the people side of this, and that's where you engage when you feel that in your heart and your gut is being pulled. It's not just a story. It's just something that you feel you've got to do. That's what he's going to be talking about later today.
And I really liked the way he got into it by saying for him it was a way to fill a column. But, of course, the way you fill a column like his is by creating a human story that pulls people in. And he got pulled in.
And that's true. And I just posted on my Facebook page his latest column about those teens at Mendez High School in Boyle Heights in California, which, if you know anything about, really very challenged area. And it's a great little story about how they're reading. They're taking their earbuds out of their ears and reading. That's going to do it for us for today. Up tomorrow, you've got something fun that we're going to talk about.
A new Kauai Community Players production. This takes a comedic look at family dynamics.
Oh, that's good. Better that than crying, I suppose.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, we'd like to hear from you on our talkback line, 792-8217. Also, you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And if you missed any of the show or want a past one, you can find them on our HPR2 archive. Look under Talk Shows for the conversation on HPR2.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning right here for more of the conversation. See you then.